Reo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. And today we're looking at two recent books about colonisation. Journalist Eugene Bingham tells the story of Te Pahi, one of the first Māori to go to Sydney and establish relationships with Pākehā, with Europeans. And academic Richard Shaw continues his work on looking at what makes us good settlers. And we also slip in a bit of crime fiction from local writer Marie Connolly, who has set her latest book up in the glaciers of the Alps and in the high-class suburbs of Otatahi. Richard Shaw is a professor of politics at Massey University's College of Humanities and Social Sciences. He has made a major contribution to the conversations about race and racism here in Aotearoa, and in particular, settler stories and the myths of colonisation. His latest book is called The Good Settler, Essays from Other People's Lands. And like his earlier two books, it's one to read if you're not looking for answers, but further provocations. Richard, your books, can't deny, have caused me to rethink things. It was a long time coming, and it's been a really productive outcome of your books. But I'm thinking that this third book is a distillation of your thoughts and your experiences, but you've pushed yourself to explore a new genre, essays.
Yes to all of those things, Maureen, and apologies for disrupting.
No.
disrupting things for you.
Very good disruption, yes. A welcome disruption.
Yeah, good. Okay, they're the best kind. They're the only kind you want, really, aren't they?
Yeah.
I haven't written in essays before, but most of my day job is spent writing things that are not unlike essays. Academic journal articles are a little bit like essays. Mm. They tend to run to anywhere between sort of 5,000 and 9,000 words, generally shorter these days. But they're self-contained little bits of stuff. So they have an introduction, some things in the middle, and then they have an end and you have to make an argument. So that doesn't seem to me to be too different from a certain kind of essay. I mean, some of the ones that are in this book, from memory, there are 15 of them, are more open-ended. And some of them are not essays, actually. Some of them are just lists of stuff that was done to or occurred to Māori by people, including my great grandfather and his descendants, but I just found it a really useful way of having a think about a series of things which I don't think I could have organized in any other way. So the essay form it wasn't like I sat down, Maureen, and said, okay, which genre am I going to try now, because I'm not a proper author. Academics are sort of authors but not really.
You're writers.
We do write. I mean, we that's the sort of core facet of the job, is we write all the time, and I've been doing this for 35 years. So the words, that form was not unfamiliar, and it just seemed a useful way to go about having a think about a series of disparate things. I don't know if they cohere. In my head, there's a very rough sort of overarching narrative which has to do with, I mean, the metaphorical language is that of amnesia and forgetting and dementia wings and coming into the light and so on. But after those first two books, which were very particular kinds of publications, this was an opportunity for me to, as you just put it really beautifully, actually, just to stand back and distill some thoughts and some views and some provocations that other people may or may not find helpful or interesting.
Well, I think if people have read your first two books, The Forgotten Coast and The Unsettled, they would welcome a third book from you. And if people haven't read those books, this third book brings in so much of what you've covered before. But as I say, in those different essays, you take risks to present them in different ways. There's humour, there's, you know, a lot of sadness in them when you look back at how we have just taken over the country and not given much thought to what we've done. That's a very simplistic way of saying it. But, you know, this is a very good way to get into the conversation if people haven't already.
That's very generous of you to say so, Mark. That would be my hope. I'm not sure that it was my intent. I'm not sure that I even had an intent when I sat down to try and capture these things that are going on inside my head. I think it is a stand. It stands happily alone. It probably works better if you've read the other two, but that's not a requirement. The other thing that I'd say, you've just triggered something. I hope I don't. You'll be a better judge of this than I am. What I really don't want to do and have not sought to do is just to bludgeon people around the head. I'm not remotely a fan of the tactic, which I've seen all too often, of some non-Māori, Pākehā, New Zealand, Europeans, whatever your preferred terminology is. You'll have seen it happen. You get a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of insight, and then you start beating other people who are sort of like you around the head. I find that profoundly inappropriate and non-productive. It's just wrong. It's kind of a loser's strategy, really. So I don't want to do that with these books. I'm not saying anybody should feel bad about themselves or their ancestors. I'm not saying anybody's responsible. Anybody alive now is responsible for what happened. In fact, I'm really, really take issue with often the way in which this is individualized and it's turned into something that you, Morin Rout, need to think about because you are somehow complicit in all of this by virtue of being the descendant of A, B, or C. I just find that profoundly counterproductive. I think I'd far rather people read these as an invitation to think about how collectively and structurally we have organized ourselves in this place in ways which profoundly disadvantage the people who were here long before my ancestors came. I don't find it useful to drop into a conversation that goes something like, okay, so what are you doing about it right now yourself? What's the thing that you are doing? Mm-hmm. Some people aren't doing a lot of really interesting stuff, which I'm happy to talk about. I think it's much more productive to think about this as a collective exercise. We have gone about as a nation designing things in certain ways which are manifestly not in the main to the advantage of Māori, particularly if you take the long view and look at the extreme kind of ultra-violent inequality which has been forced upon them by colonial administrations and which continues in many respects to be the case. I think of perpetual leases, some of which you've got down in your part of the country, plenty of which come in my part. So, it's not a matter of zeroing down on this individual person. It's a collective social issue which we are all the inheritors of and which we all have a responsibility, in my view, to just have a bit of a think about. And then maybe we do some stuff.
Yeah, and we do need to go back and acquaint ourselves with what went on because it's easy to gloss over it. And that's why, you know, some of the tacks, shall I say, or tactics you've taken are so effective. You know, you've got the quiz night essay which is really funny, and but it educates us and for instance, the first question is, do we have a constitution? I said no because I've always and the reason I say that is because I've been sort of aware of Geoffrey Palmer talking about constitutional matters. And yep. I wrongly heard that or took from that we don't have one and we need one. But I don't think that's what he was saying.
No, what Sir Geoffrey has been saying for a long time now is we need a formal codified constitution, a capital C constitution, which is interpreted by the courts. What we have is a political small C constitution, the stewards of which are really the parliamentarians and in particular members of the cabinet. But it's funny you say that, Moran, because well, two reasons. One is the reason why that quiz night essay is structured the way it is, and the reason why it leads out with that question is because I sense my viewers, having taught politics for a million years, 35 at least, we are not a hugely politically literate
No.
nation. We kind of take pride, bizarrely, in being relatively illiterate, and I think that that is not. I mean, there are reasons for this. I don't think it's accidental. I don't think it reflects on us as people. It's just something that's designed into the ways in which we are socialized and the education system that we go through. And that general pattern of not knowing things applies in other areas, especially to our colonial history. And I would say at this point that I was well into my 50s before it occurred to me to take a bit of a look at my own family's past. So I'm not proselytizing to anybody here, but I think that not knowing things, it's a term that my mate Carolyn Morris, who's an anthropologist, uses all the time. The not knowing, the not talking about, the not realizing, the not knowing is really important. If we don't even know about our basic political system, what our constitutional arrangements are, bloody hell, what else don't we know about? And I include myself in that as well. The other thing about that essay, quiz night, which I found really hard to write because it's sort of fiction and I'm not a fiction writer. But it was a lot of fun to write, and it's based upon a series of exercises that I do with colleagues here at MASC as part of the professional development program. We have a quiz because, that's one of the things that New Zealanders do. It's not a very good quiz at MASC because there are no prizes, there's no ham, there's no keg of beer. It's
No
just a
meat tray.
no meat tray, no nothing. It's useless. It's a rubbish quiz. But it's 15 questions, and now I've started saying, okay, and you have to get 75% of them right, or we're going to deport you, take your New Zealand citizenship away. But it's a sort of a good way in a live venue of getting to some things that we just don't know about, not because we're dumb or we're racist or we're bad people, none of that. It's just we just don't know because this is not how we're geared. And we are kind of weird in that respect. My partner is French. Lots of friends that I have from other parts of the world grow up in quite different environments in which those things are absolutely talked about because they are pretty fundamental. The rules by which we agreed to live together, which is essentially what a constitution is, they really, really matter. But we don't talk about them. It's a bit odd. So that's why the quiz night is in there.
Yeah, well, it makes us susceptible to taking on things like Hobson's Pledge, because we want some black and white things sometimes to hang our hats on or whatever, and so we don't know, so we take something like that at face value, and away we go.
Shall we talk about Hobson's Pledge for a
Yes,
bit?
that's a goodie.
I mean, this is. I think if there was one moment where it just occurred to me that there was so much I didn't know, it's the moment when I realised, having gone back through the historical record and with the help of people like Jonah Kibben and Vincent O'Malley and Rachel Buchanan and actual historians, I'm not an historian, I'm a political scientist, but I write about a lot of content which is historical, both political and non-political. Realised that there's no such thing. There's no thing called Hobson's Pledge. It's completely made up. It's frankly, if I can just veer slightly into colourful language, it's just bullshit, Moran. Hobson, for a start, Hobson didn't speak in English at Waitangi. He spoke in Te Reo Māori. He did not say, we are one people. He did not say, we are now one people. He said, he iwi tahi tātou. So he speaks in Māori. Hobson doesn't use the word pledge. What we know about what Hobson said at Waitangi comes almost exclusively from the memoirs of William Colenso, who was there, who wrote his memoirs when he was 80, 50 years after the events, quite a long time. And Colenso doesn't use the word pledge either. And Colenso makes it really clear that he is translating, as somebody for whom Te Reo Māori is a second language, what Hobson said from Māori into English. And neither Hobson nor Colenso nor anybody at Waitangi uses the word pledge. So Hobson pledges nothing at Waitangi. What he does do is spend a hell of a lot of time, according to Colenso, reassuring Māori that the Crown does not want to come and take its land. The Crown wants to come to exercise kawanatanga or governorship or control over its own misbehaved whalers, essentially. Mm. So this fiction about Hobson and a pledge is a complete and utter and total rot, and we should have nothing to do with it because it's bollocks.
Yes. Well, I believe that. And but how do we get the people? I mean, yes, you don't proselytise. You don't tell us what to think. You don't provide us with answers. We've got to find those for ourselves with the help of information that you provide for us. But, you know, there is a problem with getting people who are taken in by those kind of arguments. You know, we're all equal here, aren't we? You know, don't you want equality? Blah, blah, blah. It's frustrating, isn't it, to...
The blah, blah, it's interesting you say that too. Two quick things, or maybe one of them is not that quick. We're all equal here. There are factions within the current government who utterly misunderstand the phrase equality of treatment. The ACT Party in particular is endlessly banging on about equality of treatment. What they really mean is they want everybody to be treated in the same way. They want uniform treatment, not equality of treatment. And if you treat everybody in exactly the same way, and there are pre-existing inequalities that exist within the population, and I think you'd have to be spectacularly ignorant or arrogant to deny that there are, then you simply perpetuate those inequalities. Uniform treatment works to the advantage of people like me, not to the advantage of people like those from whom the land on which my mother's people established themselves in Taranaki was taken illegally. The Crown has acknowledged the illegal theft of the land in 1865. So sameness of treatment is not the same as equality of treatment, but that confusion is perpetuated and propagated by some within the current administration. So let's just put that one over there to one side. But one of the challenges, I think, is that we, including me, we grow into this country, we grow up and we arrive in this country, and there's something which Arlie Hochschild, who's a great American sociologist, social anthropologist, talks about as the deep story. It's a kind of origin story or a foundation story. And the deep story that I grew up with was the settler story. My people came here, and particularly the people on mum's side from Irish poverty. They built better lives for themselves. They built communities. They raised families. They bootstrapped themselves up into a better life. Sweet. Like, factually, that's exactly what occurred. It's a very, very strong emotional story, hence Hochschild's reference to a deep story. She calls the deep story the story that feelings tell. This is not a rational thing. It's not about facts and historical dates and blah, blah, blah. It's an emotional story that you tell. It's a creation story. And what I have only very lately really realized is that the deep story is an important aspect of my past, but man, does it gloss over a whole lot of stuff. There's a whole heap of things that are not included in the deep story. The deep story has to work really, really hard to keep, in my case, the theft of Māori land outside. In the part of the country where you live, the deep story of the Canterbury region, unless you are Ngaitahu, absolutely does not include the fact that 0.031% of the land that should have been returned to Ngaitahu ever made its way back. It absolutely does not include the fact that the Crown paid 0.02 pence per acre for the 20 million acres that it claimed to have purchased from Ngaitahu. Ngaitahu have their own story about the missing middle, the mountains which were not supposed to have been part of that of the Kemp purchase. So there's a whole lot of actual stuff that really did go on in the past, which has profound consequences for the present and will continue to have profound consequences for the future. That doesn't make it into the deep story, but I think that's why it can be really difficult to have those conversations, because when you start having those kinds of conversations, you're really challenging, inadvertently or explicitly, you're challenging people's understandings, their creation story. Mm. It's a big thing to start messing around with. And that, I think, goes some way to explaining why there can be such pushback or resistance. But the other thing I think, Maureen, is I thought about, I find myself increasingly thinking, Okay, so who's the audience here? And I wonder increasingly if, I mean, there are people whose deep story is never, ever going to enable them, encourage them, allow them, predispose them to read anything that I write. They'll just dismiss me out of hand with, you know, trope. Sweet. The people who I think I'm interested in are the ones like you and me, the ones who realise there's something not quite straight in the story, something I haven't learned, something I haven't been told, something that's consciously been written out of the school curriculum. We can see it happening. It's playing out in real time, right in front of us. It's happening again. The whole idea of balance, that's never a thing when I'm growing up. All of a sudden, you include some actual factual stuff from somebody else's point of view about a history, and it gets written out in the interest of balance. I mean, I don't know what that's about, but I do, of course. I know what that's about. That's the deep story asserting itself again. But I'm interested in those people like you and me and a bunch of others who are just sitting somewhere thinking, oh, shit, deep story, that's great. But there's something else that I just need to weave in. So I'm not really convinced that I need to worry about the hardliners who are just never going to accept anything that you or me or anybody else says. He'll just dismiss it with a sort of infantile, juvenile descriptions of wokeness and so on that people will peddle when they really just want to avoid having the hard conversation, or they're not intellectually or emotionally capable of having it. But there's a big middle, I reckon, Maureen. I mean, I've met hundreds of people in the last couple of years who like, kind of like you and like me. We grew up with our own stories. Now we just want to improve them a wee bit.
Well, Richard, this is a good start, or a good continuation. So thank you for writing The Good Settler, continuing the work that you have been doing and the thinking, the deep thinking that you've been doing. The Good Settler, Essays from Other People's Lands, is by Richard Shaw and published by Massey University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Marie Connolly is becoming a regular in our studios, not just because of her involvement in the Akaroa Readers and Writers Festival as the instigator and program director and everything, but because she now has a second crime novel to talk about. Dark Sky, her first novel, was a finalist in the 2025 Nio Marsh Awards, and her next novel is called Icefall. And Marie, that kind of makes me think of a James Bond movie. I'm sort of searching for some theme music.
Yes, indeed. I hadn't actually thought about that until after I'd become wedded to the title. But a number of people have said that
yes.
Icefall. Oh, yeah. James Bond.
Yes, crashing chords.
But in lots of ways, it just captured exactly what I wanted people to think about when they looked at the cover and saw a crevasse in the beautiful blue colours, but deadly if you fall down one.
And those who did read your first novel will instantly recognise the kind of milieu that you're taking us into, although that's a bit of a red herring, because we are in the Alps for a short part of it, but the rest of it, we're in high society, if you can call it that, in Christchurch.
Yes, that's right. And in that sense, it's quite a bit more complicated. It's been for me, it's complex with a number of things going on. And we start at a different period when something happens in the Alps. And then a long time later, we have a body emerging from the receding glacier. And so there's that going on. But then there is connections to Christchurch, and other complications start to emerge.
So, you know, with a complicated plot like this, and crime novels generally have a lot of complications because you need to throw us off the track and make us work. Where did you start? Did you start with the body in the glacier suddenly emerging?
Yes. It always starts for me in the setting. I know some people start with a plot or with the characters, but for me, it's always a place that is intriguing. And I really like beautiful places that have dark things happening in them. And so with Dark Sky, we were up at Tekapo at the Mount John Observatory. Mm. And this time we're down in the Alps. And so that took me down there, which is a fabulous thing, obviously,
oh, yes.
to do. And that's the other reason why I like the setting, because it takes me to places a number of times, so I get to know them a little better. And so it was with Icefall, because I got to know people. I got on a helicopter landing on the glacier, for example, so I got a feel of what it was like up there, because I've never climbed mountains, and I'm certainly not likely to now. So I needed to engage with people who'd done this, with search and rescue at Aoraki, and mountaineers who know about the conditions there. And I needed to look at the helicopter and see the belly of it and how they fill it when they need to go out on a rescue. And all of those things I needed to become familiar with. And so that was the great joy of setting it in Aoraki and doing the hooker walk again to the glacier. And it's such a terrific walk, and pretty much anybody can do it. It's not so challenging. And it meant that I could settle into the landscape there, if you like. And then once you start, for me anyway, once you start a novel, it then takes you on the story. So it's the complications of the things that were happening. I needed to have action throughout. And so it started to roll. And then I moved to Christchurch with the action.
Yes, because we know right from that first chapter who was with the body on the glacier when he fell in. And we can only surmise that there was some skullduggery going on somewhere for them not to have ever called in and reported this accident.
That's right. Well, that was the first mystery, really, because the police and Nellie couldn't find anything about this body that popped out of the glacier. And the very fact that the body popped out of the glacier offers some really interesting insights into what's happening in the Alps and what are people doing about that, and how do they measure the ice, and do how then sometimes they would find the remains, and increasingly so as our glaciers retreat. So, yes, I mean, there's a number of little mysteries all the way through, I think, in Icefall when we've got that context as the backdrop to the novel.
And then, of course, there's a murder out at Scarborough. In a beautiful house up on the hill, mystery there, and also I guess just harking back to the first part of the mystery, beginning with the body in the glacier, it allows you to bring in Nellie Prale and a number of the people that were involved in your first novel. So. You know, convenient. You had to.
That's right. That's exactly
not
right.
Not convenient, well mastered, shall we say.
You have to work out how you're going to get Nellie down there. Yes. And so that starts to build the story, if you like. And in the same way as the first novel, Nellie is engaged, but this time she's finding the work with the police a little more complicated than she thought. First novel was all about Nellie and her first murder and engaging with the Christchurch, the excitement of it all. This time she's in the thick of it, and she is finding the police a little more difficult than she had expected. So part of what I'm hoping is that as these books unfold, we'll also see Nellie and the changes in her life over these number of books.
Yes. We should point out, for those who haven't read your first novel, that Nellie is actually a criminal psychologist.
That's right.
And she's been an academic. She's still working in academia, but she's being pulled in. And so this is her second piece of work with many of the same people, but, you know, some new characters coming in as well. And I did want to know how much you've got to leave work for her to develop as a person and as a professional. So it must be a bit of a dilemma sometimes how much you let her, develop is the word I'm looking for, I think.
You know,
how much...
There needs to be some scope for her to do that, really,
yes.
I think.
Yeah.
And so in the first novel, we took a part of the way, and this time she's much more active, I think, and having to face the challenges that would be real in her situation of being a consultant in this environment. And so... I do hold back some things and then hopefully develop others and then leave some space so that in the next one, you know, she'll be, you know, perhaps challenged even more.
Yeah, because this is her second foray, her second case, she is starting to become a bit more forward in standing up to people and in trying to get them to understand what her knowledge base is.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And challenge them.
And it's always, there's always this rub in professional environments where different professionals have different views about what might need to be done or what, how a case may be responded to, or how a person might be better responded to, which is Nellie's area, really.
Mm.
And so there needs to be a rub, I think, in those professional environments, because it makes everybody think a little bit more about it, and how you work across those boundaries is... It's not an easy space, I don't think.
And in this one, there's a real variety of possible suspects or people of interest. You have these leading figures in the business world. You have a woman who's a very, very experienced KC, used to be a QC, KC. Mm-hmm. Now, who knows her way around criminal justice, smart. And then you have people who are, you know, who have been in the criminal justice system at the bottom, the people who've been in jail and come out and are being rehabilitated. So Nellie's got to work out and try and advise the police on various tacks she can take with.
Yes, that's right. And it's not straightforward because in this novel, we have a number of senior police involved with, and there are two cases going on in this book, and different people are involved in it. And Nellie is straddling that line between the two. And so I think that those opportunities really got a lot of characters and a lot of a
well,
lot
you've
of
given us
a
list
on.
Of them at the beginning, like a Russian novel. It goes
I
on
stole for... that from Naya Marsh, actually,
oh,
because she
you?
Always does the cast of characters.
I so like it. I like it because every so often you do need to go back and remind
yes,
yourself
indeed.
Who is who.
Absolutely. Mm. And people have told me after the first novel, because I introduced that in Dark Sky, and also Map.
Yes.
And people got in touch with me and told me how useful these things were. And so that then has, I think, become a thing in this series.
Good. Because I love a map. And
I love a map too.
Yeah, and, you know, looking at the Hooker Glacier, the hut, the discovery site, the incident site, it gives you, you know, it reminds you of where they are. And as you say, you know, the critical information we need to know about what's happening to
yes.
glaciers.
Yes. And, of course, they can use this map as they're talking to Dr. Chan, who's the glaciologist from Canterbury University, because Nellie needs also to know about how come a body would pop up in the particular place that it does and how long that would take for it to do so. And so some of that conversation happens in the university context, and both Nellie and Amy, the police constable.
Well, it's a great read, and you certainly have taken us to beautiful places, not just in the Alps, but beautiful houses, beautiful occasions, and we can look forward to a lot more and to watching Nellie as she develops more. So thank you, Marie.
Thank you.
The book is called Icefall. It's written by Marie Connolly and it's published by Quentin Wilson Publishing.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Eugene Bingham has had a stellar career as an investigative journalist across all media, newspapers, TV, digital, podcast. He came to notice for his work on the Tina Pora case and most recently a riveting podcast called Witty Underwater, which is about Witty Himaira's immersion into learning te reo. This is an experience that Eugene has had himself. He's been learning te reo for some years, and it's very much in evidence in his new book. The book is entitled The Chief and the Empire and tells the incredible story of Te Pahi, the Māori trailblazer betrayed by the crown. Eugene, I imagine that... Oh, welcome first. Lovely to have you. Where to start with the story? Because you had so many different ways of telling it and ways into the story. What was that dilemma like?
It was a big dilemma. Can I just say thank you, first of all, for this chat and also kia ora to everyone listening, and also to Mahitu Te Pahi's descendants, who I always keep front of mind when we talk about this book. But yeah, I was actually a little bit overwhelmed thinking where to start with the story because there are so many entry points to it. But with the book, I landed on the story of Tuki and Hoodoo, who were actually whanaunga relations of Te Pahi who were kidnapped by Philip, or by ship's captain on the orders of Philip Gidley King, who was the governor on Norfolk Island at that time. And it's a strange and intriguing story that sort of served as a convenient entry point to a discussion about this relationship which formed between Te Pahi and Philip Gidley King and this incredible story which unfolded thereafter.
I had heard the story way back about how they'd captured these two young men to show them how to use harakeke, and of course, you know, hadn't done their homework, and these these boys knew nothing about
that scene. Yes, just love it.
I do too.
They finally get to the point of, okay, tell us what you know about the harakeke, and these two young men just go, don't know. You should have asked our aunties, you know. yeah, it just anyway.
Well, it encaptures a lot about what was going on at that time. The
misunderstandings.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. Yeah. So yeah. Te Pahi comes in at what point?
Well, my starting point for him is I imagine him as a young boy. He would have been a young boy, sort of, I can't remember how old he would have been, but sort of 10, 11, when James Cook visited Te Whairangi, the Bay of Islands. And I sort of imagine Te Pahi as this curious boy looking out to sea and noticing this ship which was anchored in the bay, these strange waka, these very weird people who are on board who had strange clothes, kākahu, who he wouldn't have got close to them, I don't think. But I imagine, you know, there would have been reports of how they probably smelled a lot because they'd been at sea for a long time. And then the scary situation of them firing guns and cannons, which also happened in Te Whairangi. But that all sort of sparked Te Pahi's curiosity. And so then we jump forward to the early 1800s. And by that stage, Te Pahi is a rangatira, a chief. He stands on what we call in Te Tai Takarau the taumata, so the sort of the level, you know, the sort of chiefly level where he speaks from with his other rangatira, other chiefs, and there were lots along that coastline who he would have been in working in concert with. But he sort of takes a role as a māngai, which people from there have described to me as sort of like, he was like the diplomat. He was the spokesperson and diplomat. And he started really getting a reputation amongst the ship's captains for being someone who was good to deal with. He engaged with them. He first of all sort of showed them a very intrinsic te ao Māori value of manaakitanga. He wanted to look after them. They were arriving hungry and thirsty, and he looked after them, made sure they were fed, made sure they had water. But then he thinks, aha, we can trade. And so he starts trading with them. But like any good entrepreneur, I suppose, he realizes, you got to know your customer. And so he thinks, I really want to find out about these people. And that curiosity that had begun with Cook is still there and burning in him. And he wants to know, who are these people? What makes them tick? And so that's the sort of, I guess, the launching point for the point, you know, for this journey that he makes to Port Jackson, as it was then, Sydney, as we know it today.
And he's greeted and treated in a very positive fashion, isn't he? Because of his standing, because of his mana, and because of how he presented himself.
Absolutely, yeah. You've got it totally right there. That Philip Gidley King, the man who had been involved in that weird kidnapping situation, which turned out fine, by the way, but he had heard of this man, Te Pahi, and it in fact started sending him gifts and pigs and potatoes and all sorts of things to sort of really try and firm up this alliance with this rangatira, this chief. And so it's King, who by that stage has moved from Norfolk to Sydney and is now the governor of New South Wales, who hosts Te Pahi. He doesn't just welcome him, he invites him to stay in Government House. And he and his sons live in Government House for 3 months. They eat at the governor's table. And it's a real friendship that I think develops between them. They see each other, rangatira ki te rangatira, leader to leader. And they're both curious about each other, keen to form an alliance, keen to keep up this trade, to see what they could develop. And King is really good to Tapahi. He introduces him to lots of people in the colony, lots of influential people, and helps him on this journey of learning and understanding about Europeans.
And in turn, learns a lot about Māoritanga and their customs, traditions, and also their beliefs. You know, their world, Tao Māori. While he's there, he comes across this and is incensed by this miscarriage of justice, as he sees it, where convicts and a soldier or two soldiers, I can't remember.
Out it was three soldiers and a convict.
Yeah, were sentenced to death for being hungry, basically. And he intervenes.
Yeah, which is amazing. And I think it speaks a lot to him, doesn't it? It says a lot about his humanity and his compassion. These people were strangers. But yeah, he'd shown an interest in their justice system, and so he went along to court one day, watched this trial, and at the end of it, they're convicted and sentenced to death. And it's a brutal, brutal court system. There was no prosecution. The judge was the prosecutor. There was no defense. And the men got an opportunity to speak on their own behalf, but didn't really have much to say. They're convicted. And Te Pahi is outraged. He can't believe it. He sees it as a failure of leadership. Why would you kill someone? Because they're hungry. If they're hungry, it's a failure of you and your system as leaders, because of course he comes from a land of plenty. There's nobody hungry in Aotearoa, certainly where he is. You know, their marakai, their gardens are huge, and they're scooping fish out of the sea, and it's a land of plenty. Whereas New South Wales at the time was a place of hunger. You know, they were still relying on supplies from the UK just before he arrived, or around about the time he arrived. There'd been devastating floods which had wiped out crops and so on. And where these men came from down in Tasmania, it was even more, fraught. Their existence relied on maybe catching a kangaroo and eating scraps, because, you know, things weren't going well in establishing that colony down in Tasmania. So these men, it turned out, were just hungry, and they ended up stealing some pork from government supplies. Te Pahi just can't believe that you would do this. He intervenes. He goes along to prison. He goes to prison to see them, and he hugs them. He shows that empathy towards them, but he doesn't just sort of say, there, never mind, see you later, I'm off back to Aotearoa. He gets involved, and he takes a petition from them to the governor, back to Government House. He presents it to Philip Gidley King, and Philip Gidley King actually writes about the scene that unfolds and how outraged Te Pahi was. That was the point where we kind of, until recently, we didn't know much more. We didn't know what had happened. We didn't know who the men were. And so that's where I kind of jumped in and thought, well, let's see if we can find out some more.
Yes, because this isn't just an account of a remarkable Māori man and you know, things that we should know and the place that he should have in our history. But it also becomes, as I think you've said, somebody said, a bit of a detective story of tracking these people, tracking what happened to various taonga that were looted from Te Pahi, and expanding the story across multiple generations.
I guess that's where my journalistic instincts kicked in. I just had that curiosity. I really wanted to find out what we could. And so in terms of the court case, by going through initially old newspapers, I was able to identify the case just by triangulating what details we did have and knowing when Te Pahi was there. There was only one case that fit all the ticked all the boxes, so I knew that was the case we had. And then with the help of some archivists, I was able to eventually get to the New South Wales State Archives and sit there with the judge's handwritten notes, not a copy, the actual handwritten notes. And it was a real moment. It was quite emotional to sit there with these men's names in front of me. I finally knew who they were, and I knew with that we could unlock much more. I said a little mihi to them to acknowledge them and what they'd been through. And then, yeah, we were able to find out what happened next. Was Te Pahi able to save them? And a question that had been with me from the start, you know, who were these men? Who were their descendants? And do those descendants have any idea about the intervention of this Māori chief in their whānau history? So that was where I set off next.
I have to say at this point, read the book.
Yes, no spoilers.
Because we don't have time to track it, but it is a fascinating story, and I'm all the time, you know, amazed at the work that people like you and archivists do, and, you know, people like Professor Deirdre Brown, who, you know, I've known as an architectural writer, architect, but had no idea of her place in this story as well.
Yeah, well, she's a direct descendant of Te Pahi. She has a framed illustration of Te Pahi, one of only about two or three that exist, hanging in her office that she looks at every day to remember her connection to this incredibly brave man full of mana, who is, you know, she's directly related to. And yeah, she had done some amazing work, especially around his taonga. So there was a medal that had been presented to him when he left Sydney in 1806 from Philip Gidley King. And it had been stolen from his village, from his kāinga, and disappeared. And Deirdre did some amazing work in finding out what she could about it. And then in the last couple of years, I've been able to help fill in some more information. So we've been able to find out a lot more about the whereabouts of this taonga, this medal, which had been, you know, which had disappeared for 200 years. And we now know a bit more about its history. We know the family who had it before it was returned here to Aotearoa. So we're able to sort of help not only tell the story, really, but really try and help his descendants understand more about these taonga and about what their amazing tūpuna rangatira had got up to.
Mm. Yeah, because the ending for Te Pahi was tragic, it was unjust, it was brutal, and he and his whānau have lived with, well, his name had been blackened, and they'd lived with this great shame for decades.
Yeah, generation after generation had sat with mamai pain and, you know, just, they were still so proud of their tūpuna, but it was like they couldn't talk about him because he had been the subject of this terrible lie, these terrible lies and defamations and false accusations. And so, again, as someone who's been interested in stories of injustice through my journalism career, I just tore into that and really tried to find out the truth. And I think, with, you know, again, Deirdre's done some amazing work on this. We've demonstrated, you know, that this was just an absolute lie that led to his death and led to what I believe was a coordinated attack upon him, led by people from the New South Wales colony, two people in particular who, you know, came to seek their revenge against him on false pretenses, on a false charge. And you're right, it was his descendants who paid the price for that. So hopefully this book does something to, you know, finally, once and for all, although people like Dame Ann Salmond and Vincent O'Malley and so on have written about this over the years, hopefully this book, which focuses on Te Pahi, really, you know, uplifts the mana once more of this great rangatira, this great chief, and his descendants. And I hope that people can see that this is amazing story that we should know and we should be proud of.
Of course we should. I mean, I'm I couldn't be more of a supporter of that way of thinking. The book is now a video, a documentary, and a podcast well. So yeah. You are hopefully spreading the word, the information, the rebuttal of all these things of Te Pahi in many different ways.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of got a bit crazy there for a while last year trying to complete all these projects. But while I was writing the book, we were also making a documentary. So that's available on RNZ. It's a two-part documentary, bilingual documentary. And there's a podcast coming out in June, which is a much shorter version of the documentary. But I think it's real, as a journalist or somebody who's been a career journalist, it's really interesting to have all these different ways of telling a story and of being able to let people know about these amazing stories in this way.
And just to end, Eugene, I really enjoyed the way you've presented the book, because it's told in a very personal way, a very intimate way, the way you've, you know, put in your asides. It's told as if you are being spoken to, really, directly. There's nothing dry and boring about it at all. It's a very lively story.
I wanted to make it accessible and it's something that people could read, and to imagine that I'm sitting there telling the story, really. It's not an academic text. I'm not a historian. I'm not a trained historian. I'm a storyteller, and so hopefully that comes through. So thank you for saying that.
It does. The book is called The Chief and the Empire. It's by Eugene Bingham, and it's published by Allen and Unwin. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.